The 100 Years' War, the De Guesclin period. Charles V prepares for another renewal of the war against England. Now, the last time it was obvious that the Bruges negotiations were going nowhere. So let's see what's going on in the French court. Charles V's intransigent line was explained by his strong strategic position and, of course, a well-filled war chest. While the English House of Commons had maintained its traditional hostility to the collection of subsidies in time of truce, the system of permanent taxation, which now operated in France, was independent, at least in the north, on regular consent from representative assemblies. This meant that between 1375 and 1377, when war expenditures had been running at a comparatively low level, French tax revenue had continued to flow in at wartime rates. There's much evidence that even after meeting his swelling personal commitments, Charles V had accumulated a large surplus since the proclamation of the truce. In Languedoc, the Duke of Berry, Apanage, and central France, consent to taxation continued to be required, even though in these regions the persistence of routier operations had made it possible to go on obtaining grants at high levels, which had been traditional before the truce. The Duc de Berry received larger and more frequent grants of taxation during the truce than ever before. Louis Anjou secured 4 grants from the estates of Languedoc during the truce, amounting to 8.5 francs per hearth altogether. At a time when his only significant war expenditure was financing small-scale catfights in Perigord and the bribing of companies in the Rhone Valley, there were plausible reports of a great hoard of cash accumulated at the castle at Roquemaure in the Rhone. When the French king's ministers began to prepare for resumption of war after Christmas festivities of 1376, the main focus of their plans was preparing for a large fleet and an army of the sea. For the past 3 years, Charles V had been making strenuous attempts to reform the French war fleet. Jean de Vienne, who had been Admiral of France since 1373, was no seaman, but he was a bold military commander and a competent administrator. He had addressed the endemic corruption of the arsenal at Rouen. He had put in hand a program of maintenance to keep the king's galleys and barges seaworthy. In February of 1376, the arsenal had begun an important campaign of new building. Great quantities of timber had been cut down in the forests in the Seine Valley and floated down the river to be seasoned for new hulls. The skilled workforce had been increased to about 160 men. 10 new clinker-built oared barges had been laid down. More had been ordered in 1376 and yet more in 1377. Plans were being made with the Castilians for a large reinforcement of Mediterranean galleys from Seville. The Castilians, in return, applying pressure to the Portuguese to contribute their own contingent. The exact nature of their plans for the use of this formidable navy is as uncertain as anything else which has been deduced from the evidence of intercepted correspondence and interrogated agents. The south coast of England was an open, accessible, and inviting target. The evidence was that Charles V initially proposed that the ships should burn their way west along the south coast and then land an army at Milford Haven in Pembrokeshire under the joint command of Owen of Wales and the renegade English knight Sir John Minsterworth. For Owen, this marked a return to the abortive plans of 1369 and 1372 and to the dream of re-establishing an indigenous principality of Wales. What Minsterworth could contribute, or indeed expected to get out of the adventure, is more difficult to say. He must have been a plausible talker in spite of his shady past. Early in 1377, Minsterworth was sent by Charles V to Castile with instructions to organize the hire of transports and troops and the purchase of arms and equipment to be distributed amongst the Welsh after they had landed. At the same time, the French were hoping for, not for the first time, to reawaken the Scottish Lion, which had been a valuable ally before 1357. The Scots had a far greater potential than the Welsh for drawing English efforts away from France, as even Owen admitted. The main obstacle to France's ambition in this direction was the unwarlike King Robert Stuart. Robert's family interest lay north of the Forth. He had never had much time for complex politics of the border or been willing to risk his security by repudiating the truce with England. When the Scottish borderers launched occasional forays into the north of England, his reaction was to abuse them as wicked drunkards and disavow them. Yet there were signs to which Charles V's advisors may have been more sensitive to than Edward's, that the mood in Scotland was changing. Edward III in his dotage was not the terrible figure that he had been in his prime. The Scots had noticed the divisions of the English political community since his firm hand was removed. The lords of the Scottish border were impatient with the stalemate and less amenable than they had been to control by the king. These men relied on their power on extensive networks of dependents, kinsmen, tenants, friends, and followers who looked on them for leadership and patronage and for opportunities in which a poor country only war could provide. Yet they were more than gang leaders and freebooters. Sir Archibald and his cousin William, Earl of Douglas, had both been brought up in France and fought with John II at Poitiers. They and their kind lived on the harsh world of the border. They had shared a European outlook and were treated by Froissart with respect due to those who belonged to the world of European chivalry. At the same time, early in 1377, Charles V sent an agent to Edinburgh to persuade Robert II to repudiate the truce. He promised to send another embassy with more detailed proposals. According to Froissart, Robert summoned the council of the Scottish baronage and agreed, on their advice, to reopen the war. If this is true, then he shortly thought better of it, but his subjects were increasingly inclined to take matters into their own hands, irrespective of his views. They had the support of prominent officers of his court, John Mercer, richest merchant in Scotland, and long-standing friend of France, traveled to France in the spring, visited the French court, and personally inspected the preparations of the French Army of the Sea. With high hopes that the English would have their hands full with major raids on southern England, a rebellion in Wales, and possibly a Scottish invasion in the north, the French ministers set about planning their operations for the summer of 1377. The main lines of their strategy seems to have been laid down at the beginning of February, when the Dukes of Burgundy, Berry, and Bourbon, and the Constable, Du Guesclin, were all with the king in Paris. What was envisioned was no fewer than four royal armies, in addition to Jean Vienne's Army of the Sea. Two major offensives were planned, one under Louis of Anjou against the remaining English strongholds of the southwest, the other under the Duke of Burgundy against Calais. At the same time, it was intended that Olivier de Clisson would attack the two surviving fortresses held for John de Montfort in Brittany, at Brest and Auray, and that the Dukes of Berry and Bourbon would march on Carlette, its satellite fortresses in the foothills of Auvergne. Never in the memory of man had such a great enterprise been undertaken, declared the official chronicler of his reign. So we see what the French are planning, something quite grandiose to say the least. Now we're going to have to, next time, look and see what the English are doing, if anything. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.